From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. For more information, call 1-907-235-4966 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
It was 10 years ago in January of 2013 that the United Cook Inlet Drift Association, or UCIDA, filed a lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service. The lawsuit contended that NMFS had improperly shirked its responsibility when they allowed the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to pass Amendment 12 in 2012, which officially surrendered management of Alaska salmon fisheries that occur outside 3 miles offshore to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In three areas of Alaska, salmon fishing was occurring more than 3 miles offshore. In the United States Exclusive Economic Zone, or EEZ. Those fisheries, along the Alaska Peninsula and in Prince William Sound and Upper Cook Inlet, would continue to be managed by the state of Alaska, which was already managing the rest of Alaska's salmon fisheries. UCIDA, chafing under what they perceived as overly restrictive state management, cried foul. And in 2016, a federal appeals court agreed with UCIDA, saying that provisions of the Magnuson-Stevens Act require the federal government to actively manage all stocks outside 3 miles that require management. So for 3 years, from 2017 to 2020, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council mulled over what to do to satisfy the court. Alternatives included sharing management chores of the Cook Inlet EEZ with the state. But in 2020, as final action approached, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game indicated that it would refuse to cooperate with co-management, so instead the council decided to implement Amendment 14, which assumed federal control of the EEZ in the Cook Inlet as required by the court and simply closed it indefinitely. UCIDA scampered right back to court to file an appeal, and on June 1, 2022, a district court judge again ruled in their favor. Here is how National Marine Fisheries Service's Doug Duncan explained the court's latest judgment to the council in December.
The primary holdings of the court were that the closure implemented by Amendment 14 was inconsistent with the Magnuson-Stevens Act, as it relied exclusively on state management measures to achieve FMP goals with no corresponding federal management measures available to achieve optimum yield, or OY.
Achieving optimum yield, or getting the most out of a fishery, is one of the national standards of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. The court ruled that preemptively closing a fishery was no way to get the most out of it.
So as a result of the court's ruling, a new FMP amendment now must be prepared that meets the Ninth Circuit's decision, as well as the additional guidance that we received from the district court in regards to closure of the area being inconsistent with the MSA.
NOAA General Counsel Josh Fortenberry put it this way.
One maybe relevant quote from the court, it says that the record for this action clearly establishes that Alternative 4 was crafted as a thinly veiled attempt to ensure an absence of federal management, which per that court found conflicts with the Ninth Circuit's holding in UCIDA 1. So per the court, it felt that for this action, the particular closure at issue impermissibly removed federal and council oversight from the fishery.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
Council member Bill Twight wondered why acting to close this offshore area to fishing was different from keeping most federal waters in Alaska permanently closed to salmon fishing.
For a long time, I mean, since our first salmon management plans, the bulk of the federal EEZ has been closed to net fishing for salmon. which I think we all have always understood as a sort of implicit recognition that salmon management's better done closer to the rivers by the state. And so that's where I keep struggling. And I'm not at all challenging what you just read. I'm trying to understand how it is that a several decade old decision that I think is the right decision is okay. This particular decision isn't okay, because they both seem to me to represent exactly the same thing from a layman's perspective, not a legal perspective. And so if you could help me a little bit with that, I'd appreciate it.
I think a fundamental difference between the Cook Inlet area and the rest of the West area is that historically there has been no commercial fishing that has occurred anywhere in the West area. So there has not been a fishery in federal waters there. Whereas since at least back to 1954, there has been a fishery occurring in the federal waters of Cook Inlet.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Councilmember Twight continued to press.
One of the things I keep coming back to is, for instance, how we adjust the federal tack for Pacific cod based on expected removals in state waters. Conceivably, if the Board of Fish in managing PCOD essentially reserved enough harvest of PCOD for state waters to leave nothing in for federal waters, then the agency would close the federal waters. Is that correct for PCOD?
Through the chair, yes, Mr. Twight, that is correct.
Okay. So what's different here? It's pretty clear that the state-managed fisheries for salmon in the Cook Inlet area, including the tributary fisheries in the rivers, have more than enough capacity to harvest all the salmon. And the state has the ability, has the management tools necessary to do that in a manner that's responsive to in-season information. Their state's management tools are much more sophisticated and flexible than federal. Given those two scenarios, I get that the judge didn't like the argument, but I'm still struggling with why we feel like alternative four is simply not viable if we already have some level of precedent with Pacific cod for taking state harvest off the top.
Councillor Fortenberry had this answer.
Sure. Through the chair, Mr. Troy, if it's helpful too, one thing I'll point out that the court noted is that the Magnuson Act requires FMPs include a mechanism for establishing annual catch limits. So specifying catch limits every year. So by doing a preemptive proactive closure and not coming to that every year and looking at the specifications process and then saying, well, we'll look at what the state's taking out and then decide whether the federal fishery can be open. I think the court found that that was not meeting what it interpreted as the tenor of the Ninth Circuit decision, which is that if there's a fishery that's historically been open in federal waters, we should come up with a management plan. If pursuant to that plan on an annual basis, at some point we find we can't open the fishery because of total stock numbers, that's one thing. But to close it without ongoing federal oversight or continuing federal determinations about the viability of a fishery, I think that was the main concern that the court had, which is the difference really between alternative four and alternative three, where closures could happen on occasion. I think this council would probably have to consider what actions it would take in a scenario you proposed with Pacific cod, where the state wanted to take all of it in state waters. I mean, I think, you know, this council obviously has jurisdiction over federal waters only, and you do have to react to what happens in state waters. But I think this court is saying that for the portion under your jurisdiction, the council should think about how it would approach that on an annual basis, as opposed to making a permanent closure and deferring to the state without official delegation.
Alternative three would be federal management of the Cook Inlet EEZ. They would still use state resources to assess the fishery, but without delegating authority to the state. This alternative has real challenges. The Fed is not set up for in-season management. One option for Alternative 3 would be to set a hard closure date at July 15th to avoid overfishing, but that could chop the season off short, too. Alternative 2 would share management with the state, as they do very successfully with crab fisheries.
Alternative 2 is the delegated management alternative. This delegates specific management authorities and the FMP to the state. It also retains specific federal management responsibilities under the purview of the council and NIMS. Under alternative two, there would be an annual or regular council management cycle to adopt the harvest specifications for the fishery. And then much like the crab fishery or the scallop fishery, the state would then carry out in-season management of it under is what could be considered analogous to their harvest strategy. And two other things that I'll note about alternative two that make it somewhat unique is that in order for a council to delegate management authority to a state, it requires a three-quarters majority vote of the council rather than just a simple majority vote. And then the state must accept the delegation of management. NIMS would not implement a delegated management regime if it knew that the state would not carry out the responsibilities delegated to it by the council.
But alternative two was the one they were eyeballing last time when the state abruptly shot it down by announcing they had no interest in co-management. Could that happen again? Here is Councilmember Twite.
If the council decides that alternative two is the best alternative and a three-quarter majority vote to adopt it, what happens if after that vote and after the secretary has begun to implement rules, at some point the state formally declares they're not willing to accept it? Where does that leave us? Do we have to go back to the drawing board or what's the... Or are you suggesting that it's unlikely that there'd be, for instance, a federal vote for that without knowing with a high degree of confidence that the state was willing to accept it?
Pass to Mr. Fortenberry to elaborate.
Sure. Through the chair, Mr. Dwight, just to help with the process of how that might work. If the council voted to delegate management to the state, and then afterwards the state informed NIMS or the council that it would not carry out the duties of the delegation, likely NIMS would disapprove the council recommendation because we couldn't be assured that the goals of the FMP or the MSA would be accomplished through that proposal. So it would come back to the council. You know, obviously here we're under a litigation deadline. So if it comes back to the council with not much time, I'm not sure where that would leave you. So again, I agree with Mr. Duncan. It's probably best if those objections were registered before final action.
So even though alternative two looks like it could be the best option to achieve optimum yield, it still could be scuttled by the state just as it was last time. Has the state's position changed in the last couple of months? Hopefully, we shall soon see.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.